Group meeting, Sunday, 11th March, 1984. We have spent the months since last September in trying to free ourselves from various unwarrantable beliefs, ideas, convictions, and superstitions. It is important to do this because if the mind is free of its clutter, then it becomes possible for the individual to see truth directly for himself. Now we must be very careful what we mean by seeing truth. In the ordinary way, when we say that I see something, I understand something, it simply means I have some concepts about it, some ideas about it, and these I can express in words. And when it seems as if it is very, very intense, then I say, ah, yes, this is quite true, I agree with that. And you accept it as truth. This has nothing to do with truth. To see truth in the supreme sense of those words, to see truth means to be clearly conscious, wholly conscious of the reality. Now this whole consciousness of reality is quite beyond concepts and words. Then naturally one says, well, why talk at all? A very good question. Why talk at all? And in fact, if there was very much less talking in the world would be a quieter and a happier place altogether. But concepts and words can sometimes just give that sort of impulse which enables an individual's consciousness to wake up, so to say. And then you are really conscious of that which you are observing. Otherwise you are not. And when one is truly conscious in that supreme sense, then that consciousness also is expressing all the time wisdom, love, truth, beauty, goodness, everything. Now, I don't know whether this has been put forward in these terms previously by anyone. This being conscious is a tremendous thing, and I say it is tremendous for this reason. The evolution of the whole human race reaches its culminating point with the evolution of consciousness. And when consciousness reaches its peak point, then one lives in terms of a perfect awareness of the unitary wholeness of the universe. Now the perfected holy ones must necessarily have experienced this. They must have realized this. In the case of the supreme ones amongst the perfected ones, and there are grades, if you like, of perfection too, you see. Amongst the supreme ones, they must have realized that state as a permanent state throughout their life. A permanent background state from which was the sort of soil, the source from which came all their religious teachings. Whether those religious teachings were concerned mainly with living the religious life, which means essentially living the ethical life, or whether they're concerned ontological matters, God, man, and the universe, and the relationships between them, and so on. So they must have been conscious that way. And it is to that sort of consciousness that the human race is slowly moving. I don't think that the human race as a whole has any idea whatever that that is the direction in which we are all moving. We may say this about it. One purpose of our existence in the world is just so to live that we promote that purpose being fulfilled. Namely, that the unitary, that consciousness in terms of the unitary wholeness of the universe comes to fulfillment and therefore becomes totally operative in our lives. Of course, the human race will be a very angelic race as and when that kind of thing can happen. But we mustn't think of it in terms of the whole of humanity doing it. It will happen only in terms of different individuals realizing it. Already during the last 6,000 years, we have had several hundreds, I won't say thousands, but several hundreds of perfected holy ones. The Buddha mentions 104 names in one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. In the third volume you'll find it. I think it's the Isigili Sutta. Now, if that is the purpose of our existence, then we must try to have some sort of feeling, some sort of vision of what it means, what the word action means. Practically the whole human race thinks of action as composed of so many little bits which are called acts. This act, that act, and so forth. His act, her act, my act, your act, the action of the government, the action of a group of people, and so forth and so forth. But we are conscious only in terms of little bits. We are not conscious in terms of the unitary wholeness of action, which means the unitary wholeness of karma. Karma means action. But its supreme meaning is in the transcendental sense of the creative action of the creative energy which is eternal and infinite. So why are we conscious in this split-up manner? Because we ourselves are incapable of an all-encompassing consciousness. We are finite, temporal, and mortal. And therefore our constitution itself is not conducive to that transcendental consciousness of action. Not merely a view of action or a conceptual understanding. What I am doing is trying to present a conceptual understanding. I can't do any more. No one in the world can. As long as that person, however perfected or however holy, has a physical body. And the physical body inherits all those elements which contradict and oppose the transcendental consciousness. The brain itself, I have mentioned this in past meetings. We have the brain stem, which controls the bodily processes, especially heartbeat and respiration and so on. We have the crocodilian brain surrounding that, which is the seat of fear and aggressiveness and all those elements, inherited from our reptilian ancestors hundreds of millions of years ago. We have it all in us. The whole history of the development of the animal kingdom is embodied in us. And surrounding that, there is the mammalian brain, mammals who are not yet primates. And from them, we inherit the affection and care for the young and protectiveness and all those qualities. And in addition to all that, we have the cortex, which is the instrument, the apparatus through which the transcendental aspects of consciousness can function. So you see, even the perfected holy ones can't throw out of their heads the reptilian and the mammalian parts of the brain. So they have all those elements which they have to contend with, so to say. They don't contend with it, actually. They observe it. They understand it. And in the observation and understanding of all those aspects, they are able to present their teachings as regards the living of the religious life in the best possible form for their time, their age, and their culture and their surroundings. You see, because they understand very well that if they understand themselves completely and perfectly, they have understood every other single human being on the face of the globe. So now, back to this business of action. We see it all in little bits because we are, as I say, finite and temporal and very much under the thraldom of the reptilian and mammalian parts of the brain. Mind you, those parts of the brain are just the apparatus. But although they are just the apparatus, they are also the source from which influences flow out to which make us act like the reptile or the mammal. Fear and aggressiveness and all the rest of it is due to that fact. Now, I talk of unitary wholeness. Consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness means omniscience in the true sense of the word. Don't interpret omniscience as an encyclopedic knowledge of everything that there is in the universe. Knowledge can assist one to become conscious, but in itself is often, all too often, an obstruction to becoming consciousness of reality, of truth. No amount of knowledge will release wisdom. If knowledge, which is the special province of the brain, is combined, is in perfect harmony with understanding, which springs from love, then you can have wisdom operating. Wisdom is loving knowledge which has been transmuted through the operation of love. So now, this consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness is a meaning of omniscience as such. Now, when an action is over, if it ever is really over, karma is completely finished. We have had this teaching for the last 3,000 years or more of past karma, present karma, future karma. This is all an erroneous way of looking at it. Karma operates instantaneously. And it continuously operates instantaneously. that continuity proceeds at such a speed that we are unable to be aware of it. It escapes us. If we were fully conscious, fully aware of the immediate, of the action in its wholeness, if we are immediately aware of the wholeness of an action, then we would find that when the action is over, there is no leftover. It is this leftover part which is the trouble. This leftover is mainly in terms of memory. We all know from our own life experience how full of memories we are. And we all know what the response is when a memory from the past comes up. A reaction of misery or hate or remorse or regret or self-esteem or pleasure or whatever it is. You see, that is due to the memories which are all locked up in the brain and the whole nervous system and so on. Then again, an action, there is an aspect of action which for us as individuals remains unfinished because it has affected our society and our environment. Once we do something, we can't do anything about the other persons or the environment as such. The action has had its effect. And having had its effect like that on society and environment themselves produce more and more effects. See, this is the extraordinary thing about karma, that its wholeness, because karma is the living process of the entire universe, its wholeness is of such a nature that it eludes our perception. Science knows now, as a matter of fact it began to know that from the beginning of this century, that the slightest action, slightest activity here and now affects the furthest star. It was James Jeans in his Mysterious Universe, I think, who first put that idea out. And those of us who are concerned with religion and with the deeper psychological and spiritual aspects of human life, we can see that that is quite true. That any one thing affects the totality. And the totality affects the one thing, and all the separate elements of that totality, each individually affect totality and oneself. You see, it's an extraordinarily complex activity. Its complexity is the thing that philosophers and teachers of religion and so on have missed out. They haven't been able really to penetrate into that. But from now on, it certainly will be possible to penetrate into that. That doesn't mean that we shall penetrate into every individual action and its reaction and so forth. That is not necessary. So long as one knows the general principle on which it works, then one can be truly circumspect as regards one's own activities. Where we need a great deal of clear perception is in terms of the nature of the principle at work. And the nature of the principle essentially is whole action. It is a universe. A one thing. And it is extremely difficult to be aware of it in those terms. Now, this memory which gets stored up in us can act in several ways. it may incite us to repeat the action in order that we may obtain the desired satisfaction which we did not obtain before. Or it may be merely to obtain an enhanced satisfaction, an enhanced pleasure from the experience as such. So we keep on repeating it. One must look carefully into one's life and see in what fields particularly this is very true. It is especially and has been especially true for the whole human race throughout all time with respect to all that concerns affection for the mate, for the family, and so forth. You will find that it is operative. So we have that same incitement with respect to the things of life which concern our relationship with our environment, with the external world as such. Then again, the memory of the past can, if we are sensible, and of course the sensible people of the world are definitely in a minority, it can save one from repeating a previous mistake. You may have noticed, looking at people's lives, at one's own life maybe also, how we repeat the same mistake again and again. When in my 20s, I thought what a foolish fellow I was in my teens for having done this, that, or the other. In my 30s, I thought the same about my 20s. In my 80s, I think the same, well, not quite the same about the 70s. I think they have been a bit quieter and calmer, you see. But it is like that. Or again, the memory may help in developing a technique or a capacity for skillful right action. This applies particularly in all the activities which concern material skills. For example, a musician, a pianist, the repetition, he has to practice again and again and again, play the same thing over and over again for hours at a time in order to gain perception, perfection with the music. But we mustn't forget that although he is performing, carrying out a physical repetition, there is also a psychological process going on at the same time. The feeling awareness with respect to the music, as well as the intellectual awareness of the structure of the music, is growing all the time. I mean, this I know from my own experience, so I can give that as an example. So by repetition and by the activity of memory, the performance becomes better and better and better, because you remember that when I did it yesterday like that, it wasn't really the perfect thing. And your sense of perfection grows with it at the same time. So memory is not an obstruction there, it is a help. After an action is over, a memory is there because the action was incomplete. We all believe that, oh, I've done this now, it's finished. I've cooked the lunch for today. But the action isn't finished really. Or you may be in the office and I've done the accounts for today and so forth. But it isn't finished. When you've done the accounts and you're back home, and you think, now did I put in that correctly or did I do this rightly, etc. You see, there is a questioning, an uncertainty. Very rarely is any action a complete, finished action. And now I'm using the word finished in the sense of not done with as regards all the details of the act, but finished in the sense of perfected. When a musician gives a lovely performance, you say, what a finished performance that was. In that sense, very rarely are our actions throughout our life, a finished action in that sense. If one understands action in that way, one will realize the profundity of the statement in St. John's Gospel, the last words, it is finished. What was the particular action demanded of Jesus during his lifetime? To bear witness to the Father in heaven. Bearing witness to the Father in heaven is not like being a witness in a court of law. But to live in such a manner that divinity itself found unhindered, perfect expression through that life. That was the bearing of the witness. And Jesus declared, it is finished. It's done. Good work. Now, an action is not only a material doing, it also involves the psyche, the elements of desire, pleasure, fear, attraction, revulsion, love, hate, gain, grasping, all those elements and many others in the psychological sphere play their part in relation to any action. There is no action which is entirely mechanical. All mechanism, apart from the motor car itself, has its all our action by all action by human beings has not only its physical part, but very definitely its psychological part, and also a spiritual part, which essentially is the working of consciousness in the process of the action. Is one's consciousness functioning as a pure and complete awareness? Or is it self-centered, isolative, and separative? For consciousness to function as a pure and complete awareness, of course, that implies a perfected human being. Because all our ordinary psychological factors which come to play in any action are considerably tainted factors. They are not utterly pure, and they affect consciousness itself. Physical action, one's psychological life, whole life, and one's mental states, they all affect consciousness. Consciousness remains the absolutely pure, untainted element in our life. Whatsoever may be the states of mind, the psychological processes, and the physical actions. But the influence of this, the mortal aspect of our being, the influence of this affects consciousness, not to change consciousness in the ordinary meaning of the word change, but it brings forth a response. Now, if consciousness is obstructed, by a conditioned brain, as is probably the case in every single human being, including the founders of the religions. That is why those perfected holy ones were not able to escape the limitations of their time, their culture, their circumstance, and the particular knowledge and understanding they had of the material world and of human behavior. All that grows. You see? So, I think there has come the time when there will be a real transmutation taking place. We've had how many? 3,000? About 5,500 years of teachings, starting with Zarathustra. Starting with Zarathustra, approximately 1500 BC, 3,500 years of it. And in those 3,500 years, there has been a very interesting change taking place in the manner in which the founders of the religions have presented their teachings. I'm not including in this Muhammad. He grew up in a situation where the people were such that it was impossible for him not to do some of the wrong things, telling them to go to war and slay the infidel and all that sort of nonsense, you see. But there has been a change. When you look at the teachings of Zarathustra and Moses, who was after him, by just about 300 years, you will find that the element which came to fruition with the Buddha and Jesus in terms of compassion and love, they are not there. Zarathustra in his Gathas has said, if the evildoer does you wrong, strike him with a weapon. And our very devoted and enthusiastic Parsi scholars particularly always put within brackets, strike him with a spiritual weapon. You try and strike all the devils in the world with spiritual weapons and see what happens. You see, it is absolutely essential to have the mind so clean that it will accept the fact of whatsoever happens. We can afterwards call it good, bad, indifferent, or whatever you like. We can call it divine or we can call it devilish if we like. But we must be capable of seeing the fact as the fact. Look at it this way. The Lord God created the universe. The primordial creative energy emanated the entire universe. Does that primordial creative energy chuck anything out of the universe because it doesn't like it? Or because it thinks this is bad, I don't want it? It just doesn't happen that way. Everything is included. The consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness accepts everything. You know, this is one of the things I believe that Krishnamurti is trying to do, to wake people up to the fact that we have to be conscious in this all-inclusive manner, rejecting nothing whatsoever, and by the same token, accepting nothing whatsoever in the sense that this is the final truth, this is to be kept forever and ever without any change and so forth. When one has that kind of elasticity within oneself, one can perhaps help one's neighbor without imposing one's own ideas upon him. Now, if consciousness is obstructed by the psyche, then it will be clouded over by illusions. Because the psyche will throw up all sorts of wishful visions before one. One would like life to be like this and the world to go on like that and so forth and so forth. And so consciousness will be enwrapped in like a fly in a spider's web with illusions. And for us, the psychophysical part of us will have no chance for choiceless awareness. Our awareness of the whole life process should be really choiceless, taking no sides whatsoever. If I took sides against the devil, how can I help him to become a god? Of course, he's in myself all the time. We criticize ourselves, we curse ourselves, and so forth. I have done it myself throughout my life for making this mistake or that mistake and so forth. But it doesn't help at all. Invite the devil in. Give him a nice cup of tea. You see, in England that would be very, very acceptable. And gently let him work himself up, and you will find that he's suddenly grown golden wings. But that is how it is. I mean, psychologically, it's a tremendous job. One must understand in that way, the way which is inclusive. If consciousness is obstructed then by the brain and by the psyche, then states of mind, moods, feelings, thoughts, speech, daily deeds will be anything but pure, true, wise, good, loving, or beautiful. They will not be there. They will be anything but human, human in the real sense of the word. The happy creator. They will all be subhuman. So now the question arises, how do we move out of this state of being, blind children of mortality? How do we transform ourselves into truth-seeing, deathless humanity, from bondage and sorrow into freedom and bliss? Well, the answer is very simple, and that is the difficulty with the answer. It is so simple that it is practically impossible to achieve in double quick time. Use the senses rightly and fully. That is the first step, which will be the one step all through our life. Use the senses rightly and fully. Never indulge the senses, but utilize them. If you indulge the senses, you can have an immense amount of pleasure which dies, and therefore one is left with feelings of, oh, it's all over, what a pity, and all the rest of it. But if you use the senses rightly, then there is true happiness which never dies, because it was never born. It is inherent in the totality of life. It is inherent right throughout the universe, this happiness, this bliss, actually. The Buddha said, at the heart of all things lies eternal bliss. Now, that bliss inherent in all existence pours itself out without selecting anybody or anything. It pours itself out totally and fully. Now, if we use our senses rightly, it will come to us. You have all experienced it in some form or other, whether it be in marital relations between husband and wife, or whether it be in terms of stepping out into a lovely starlit night, or seeing a marvelous sunset. I have experienced this sort of thing, particularly in India, and here too, in England. But some of those sunsets in countries like India and in Sri Lanka, they are truly divine. There's something absolutely magical about them. And they have a real transmuting effect upon one's whole being. It's indescribable. We can put it in another form. Be wholly observant, which includes being completely and skillfully active. Because being active means not only observing with the senses, but the whole of the psyche is intensely sensitive to what is happening. And consciousness itself experiences a transformation in true observation. You observe the impulse which you get from the external world, and you observe the response from the brain. The brain is always chattering. With me, my tongue is also always chattering. But observe that chatter, and understand it. See what its quality is. In each one of us, there is embodied a moral imperative which derives from the fundamental Ritta, as the Rig Veda put it, Asha, as Zarathustra put it, which is inherent in everything in the universe. All perfection is here, inherent. Our task is to let it out. We have been given a very difficult task by nature in giving us as our heritage the effects of our reptilian and mammalian ancestry. It's a difficult task, a very difficult task. But, as the Buddha said, at the end of his life, strive on with diligence. Appamadena sampadeta. Wonderful words. I like to put them in modern English form. Keep going without flagging. Which a dear German translator translated into German by saying, keep going without waving flags. Let us end on that happy note.